This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. You can email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. We start today with Ajel Bradford, an up-and-comer. She's involved in various and sundry matters in our community, lives in New Orleans, where she is a doctoral candidate at the Tulane
School of Medicine.
And she went to Woodlawn here in Baton Rouge, and she is also a volunteer leader with the Sierra Club. And we've got a few things to address with her. And again, your number is 877-217-5757. We'll largely be talking about other matters today if things go according to plan. But with an hour's despair, President Biden last night signed legislation to avoid a partial federal shutdown to keep the government funded through December 3rd. Congress had passed the bill earlier yesterday. The House approved the short-term funding measure 254 to 175. The Senate passed it 65 to 35. Ajel Bradford, if we look at the front page today, we see that sewage oozes in Baton Rouge streets and homes. Treatment plan fails during heavy rain. Untreated wastewater, this is a story from Paul Cobbler, oozed onto residential streets and into several dozen homes after a sewage plant in southern East Baton Rouge Parish failed during a sudden heavy thunderstorm. It is a continuing problem in this area, and something as a volunteer leader with the Sierra Club that you're analyzing and assessing. What do you make of this?
I cannot speak specifically to sewage, but what I will say is we've been commenting for years about the flooding concerns and the drainage concerns around East Baton Rouge Parish, and recently had a press release that was actually taken up by the Advocate around the recent moratorium that we eventually ended up supporting, just because we do need to put a stop to the excessive development in wetlands and in floodplains. And of course, this is just another demonstration of that problem. And so our entire year has really been about infrastructure, whether at the federal level or the local level, and what can we do to have better solid systems as it pertains to infrastructure.
Well, we had a councilman on this show not so long ago, Rowdy Godet, and he has been pushing for this sort of thing. But old habits die hard.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it stand right now as far as the changes that you feel are necessary?
Yeah. So for folks that don't recall or weren't following, the moratorium, of course, required that 10%, well, post-construction should have 10% less runoff than pre-construction. And we weren't exactly clear on how that's achieved, but we ultimately supported it because if we're going to have to build in floodplains, or if folks are going to choose to build in floodplains and wetlands, then we do need to have stricter provisions for that. And we thought it was a nice hold until a year from now, whenever the stormwater master plan drops. And hopefully that will be more aggressive policies that the Metro Council and Planning Commission will pick up.
We have issues with flooding. Those were in full bloom in 2016, but that was largely unavoidable. But some of these current dilemmas people feel are avoidable. Do you share that assessment?
You know, it was avoidable, but we've gotten to a point where we've built out so much in floodplains and wetlands that living with water seems to be something that we're going to have to deal with. And whether it's climate change that's driving these intense rain bouts that we're seeing, like we saw yesterday, or whether it is man-made development in these wetlands and floodplains, we're going to have to figure out a better way to build in Baton Rouge. And that might mean more densely, and that might also mean shifting investment into other parts of the parish that are less bountiful with wetlands and floodplains. But we can't continue to just go out to Burbank and out to Starring Lane and build out there. So there does have to be a shift, or folks are just going to have to get used to flooding. That's just the reality that we're at, especially in the climate crisis.
What will it take to make that shift happen?
Hopefully the stormwater master plan will be aggressive. There are some components that are folks in the Sierra Club, the Baton Rouge group, which is a part of the Delta chapter, that they've been commenting on and supporting for years, going to the hearings, which includes an evaluation of drainage, whether it is the pipes as well as the watershed. And so if we can really honor what the stormwater master plan, which is probably another fight, advises, then I think we can move forward.
Ajel Bradford is with us for a few minutes. Her position is volunteer leader with the Sierra Club Delta chapter. And again, 877-217-5757. And there have been concerns about development contributing to the flooding that we've had of late that has been intense. And it's hard to reverse something that's already happened. What can be done at this point? It's hard to fathom buildings coming down, but what do you think can be done in the short term?
I will add, now that I think of it, the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, which EPA adheres to, and then the Army Corps of Engineers looks at the permit for whenever folks want to build here in East Baton Rouge Parish. That Section 404 allows for mitigation banks. So essentially, developers can invest in a wetland that's offsite. If we could kind of stop those practices, we think that that would help, because wetlands have so much more value than flood mitigation. They also help with preventing heat islands. It's a quality of life thing just as much as it is a development issue. And so our mitigation efforts or not building in these areas have to center wetlands and really look at the cumulative loss of wetlands, not just can you offset that loss somewhere else that doesn't necessarily impact East Baton Rouge Parish.
Maria in Ascension Parish notes that flood insurance is now through the roof.
Yeah.
And Jim Donilon, our insurance commissioner, has stated that it's a necessity. Many areas that were considered flood-proof are now flooding. But Maria asks, why isn't there more widespread concern about this, at least voice from the populace about the flooding issues that she believes and you believe could be averted?
Yeah. I would, you know, we would love to see more engagement from anybody in the public that feels passionate about this issue, and the recognition that all of these pieces that we're seeing, from hurricanes to flood events, are part of the climate crisis. And what Maria is talking about really leads us back to the federal work of the Build Back Better Act, and then, of course, the legislation that just passed around disaster relief. We really need to get our congressional leaders to prioritize addressing the climate crisis. And included in that is, how do we actually afford flood insurance moving forward? Because it's going to be necessary.
You're 29 years old, as you told me. And so you live here. You may spend the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You'd probably like to. You live in New Orleans. Were you here during Ida? The night it came
through? No, I left. I left with my sister. I can't do after a Category 2 anymore. I'm out.
Where'd you go?
We went to Dallas.
Okay. That's probably a bit safer.
Yeah.
And that's understandable. Just don't move there. But many young people are moving, and that's one of the reasons. We're in a danger zone, and a lot of it has to do with climate change. And unfortunately, our congressional delegation is not doing a whole lot about it. Some of them talk about it, but when it comes down to really doing something, if anything, they're siding with the industry, which some people believe is largely responsible for this.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we change that inertia?
Yeah. So, of course, the quick and easy answer is get new congressional leaders. But for now, we need more folks letting them know that this is a priority, because the Sierra Club, the Delta Chapter, and the Baton Rouge Group have been meeting with all congressional leaders, staff, this entire summer to get them to understand that we want the Build Back Better plan, not just the bipartisan, which is a lot of the same status quo of infrastructure investment. We want Build Back Better, which actually centers climate and workers. We also launched a campaign called Fair Access Ride Equity, which is about public transportation for all here in Louisiana and making it ubiquitous for all Louisianans. Because the reality is, we don't have systems, particularly transportation systems, whether it's for evacuation or for daily workers, that works for people.
Angel Bradford, that's a name to remember. And some of these members of Congress, and it's not just Republicans either. We only have one Democrat. But I would suspect even if you talk to Troy Carter, he would give you some variation of what the Republicans are saying, because we do live in a state that treasures its oil and gas industry and its chemical industry. It would say, look, we can have it both ways. We can have big industry and we can have good environment. Is that possible?
Not anymore. No, those days are over. But what we can have is a just transition for our workers. We don't want to leave behind oil and gas workers. There's plenty of jobs, as has mentioned in the Build Back Better Act, that centers workers in oil and gas, gets folks trained in plugging wells, creates a civilian climate corps, much like the public works that other generations saw under the New Deal, and really invest in communities and caregivers and the elderly, whether it's extended child credit, whether it is a funding and a union opportunity for caregivers. We're trying to take care of the whole person, and we're not going to leave folks behind in this just transition off of oil and gas. But we need to pass the Build Back Better Act to do that.
And I can tell from a few emails, you scare people when you say not anymore. Does that mean we immediately have to shut down all these plants?
I mean, I don't think we can. They're so powerful that we're not going to be able to immediately shut them down. But we have to get honest about the fact that our carbon emissions and other emissions are increasing. It's killing our populations, our pollution levels. And transportation in Louisiana, for example, is the second largest contributor to carbon emissions, and industry is the first. And so if we want to be able to live in Louisiana, we're going to have to be real about the challenge that we have ahead of us. And climate crisis is built in for the next 30 years. So a lot of my life is about to be under this new era of climate change.
Do you have an electric car?
I don't, but I'm getting one. That is my goal when I graduate. And I got this really dorky Toyota Corolla hatchback because the miles per gallon is 60 miles per gallon on the highway. So I am working towards it, okay?
All right, we'll be back and spend a few more minutes with Angele Bradford of the Sierra Club and Steve Miley of Allied Systems after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Angele Bradford, volunteer leader for the Sierra Club. Remember the name. She soon will become Dr. Bradford. She went from Woodlawn High to Tulane Med School, where she is getting a PhD and in physiology, right?
Yes, in physiology.
In physiology. Where'd you do your undergraduate work?
Ohio State.
Oh, the Ohio State.
The Ohio State, yeah. But I never had the.
What?
I never say the yeah, it yeah, seems a yeah, bit much.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, we ought to call the Louisiana State University, right? Well, Ohio State, Columbus, Ohio's a lot like Baton Rouge. The weather's a lot different, but capital city and a big university, a state university.
Yeah.
And they're crazy about football. And we'll get to Steve Miley in football in Baton Rouge in just a moment. But before we part company with Angele, I know Valerie in Shenandoah has been waiting. Valerie, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Good morning to both of y'all. Angele, thanks for joining the program. It's great to hear from you. What I'd love to hear more about, and maybe your background in medicine could help, is fossil fuels and how it contributes to health effects and also maternal health. And it just feels a little bit ironic that this isn't being discussed more in Louisiana, particularly where there seems to be, you know, pro-life advocacy and things like that. So I'd love to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, so we have incredible partners and coalitions that we support that do a lot of work in what was called Death Alley and now it was called Cancer Alley and now they call it Death Alley. And there's extensive conversations around benzene and other types of carcinogens that are emitted from these plants. There's extensive studies actually around folks that are more likely to have asthma or lupus or cancer clusters that are often denied by industry. And so if you follow people doing work in Death Alley, whether those are folks fighting against the Formosa plastics plants, all of those websites, Rise St. James, those groups really do elevate both the health impacts and then just the quality of life impacts of industry, particularly next to Black and Brown communities. But of course, Ascension Parish is one of those areas that deals with Death Alley also.
And another listener before we part company sending an email. This is Tracy at the Capitol, has talked about your comment that we need more, or we need better, not more better. We need, we need better congressional people. Have you thought about running for office?
Oh my gosh. I keep wanting to just finish my degree. But with the climate crisis, I mean, I'm not opposed to it. I'd rather convince everybody else around me so I don't have to do it. But, you know, not opposed.
Well, you're young enough to decide, but we need more good people. And, you would be, along with Julia Letlow, not only the only female if you were in Congress, you'd be the most educated person in Congress.
Oh.
You know, Julia has like three more degrees than some of the other members of the congressional delegation.
I did not know that.
By herself, just by her lonesome.
Yeah.
Charlotte in New Iberia. Charlotte, you're on with Angele. Oh, Charlotte, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Jim. Good morning to your guests. I'd like to ask whether she would state that the allegation that the people who have cancer near those plants have those problems because of poverty versus the industries.
There are other factors, and we have a lot of bad habits, too. We smoke, we drink, we don't exercise, we're fat, we're not healthy in other ways. So is it fair to blame it on the plants?
It's everything. But I think it's so easy for industry to contribute to that narrative of like, oh, it's just poverty. But yeah, industry also is contributing to poverty. They're not giving taxes into these areas. And so it's all of the things. It's cumulative effects of multiple plants around these communities. And it's the consequences of poverty, which we try to address with the Build Back Better Act. And so we have to support it and also get serious about the multiple impacts of having industry have such an influence on our politics and our way of life and how that impacts our communities.
All right. Well, let's stay in touch. I don't think we heard the last of Angele Bradford, who's trying to do good work and has a great mind and is, will soon be Dr. Angele Bradford. So,
well, thank you.
So good luck to
you. I'll stay in touch. All right.
Like that. And we're joined in studio now by a gentleman I've known for a few years, Steve Miley, a member of our Saturday Coffee Group. I think he was invited in by the late, great Mike Dana many years ago, and he comes every Saturday to a super secret location, and I've known Steve, and he's a business guy. In 1987, he and his family started Allied Systems in 83, right?
That's right.
And he and his brother?
Yes,
Truett. Run the show, and it's a place where a lot of people go for security, and we're not here to talk about that. But since I brought it up, I bet a lot of people in this age, they're looking for a fortress to guard their homes and businesses, right? They want protection.
We've been very busy, yes. Crime appears to be up.
You really? Really?
Yes.
I don't think there's any doubt. It's not a laughing matter, and it is good to have good security. But the reason he's here is that 43 years ago, he began his work as the videographer for the LSU band. And in that time, he has not missed a home LSU football game. Not one. That's quite a streak.
I need to correct you. I was in the Tiger band starting in 1979. I played the sousaphone until 1985. And when I graduated, I became...
You were on the six-year plan?
I was on the seven-year plan. I graduated in 4.5. And then I continued to be in the Tiger band while I was out of school. I don't think they allow that.
So you haven't missed a home game since you were a student then?
Right. My first game was in high school, was the Wyoming game in 78. And that was the last game of the season. And the next year I was in the band, and it hasn't ended since.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Hokie Gajon ran a kickoff back for a touchdown in that game against Wyoming in 78. And there have only been two LSU players to do it at Tiger Stadium since. But Tiger Stadium has this magical quality. For those of us who live here, we may not appreciate how it's regarded around the country, if not the world. It is quite a place. And Saturday night, where are you usually perched?
On the 50-yard line in the press box. It's a seat.
Pretty good seat, right?
Somebody has to do it. So.
You rub shoulders with Dan Bornay?
Every once in a while. We do his security system. So,
do you?
Yeah.
And I'm sure Dan has security coming in and out of the game, like Coach O.
Oh, I think he has three or four state troopers.
Yeah, it always perplexes me why these football coaches need more security. You know, the volleyball coach doesn't have security. The baseball coach doesn't have three state troopers around him. Why does a football coach, this big burly guy, as Donald Trump said, big strong man, why does he need three security guards around him, Steve Miley?
Well, I think you bring up a good point. We need to set up a security detail for the band director. So.
But it should be a requirement for all LSU coaches to be able to bench press their weight, something that Steve can do. And today is his 60th birthday, number 60. So happy birthday, Steve Miley.
Thank you. He's got that zero back there.
Yeah, born 10-1-6-1. 6-1-6-1 is Sean Riley, but you're 10-1-61. And it was on this date in 1961 that Roger Maris, the pride of Fargo, North Dakota, hit home run number 61 for the New York Yankees off Tracy Stallard to become the all-time single-season home run leader for the major leagues, and it's still an American League record. All the steroid guys were in the National League, Bonds and McGuire and Sosa. But this is the pitch described by the Yankees incomparable announcer Mel Allen on your birthday. Steve was being born about this time on Sunday, October 1, 1961.
Fastball hit deep to right. It could be it. Way back there. Oh, now he's in. Roger Maris.
Holy
Mel Allen. 60 years ago today, Steve Miley was born, and Roger Maris, who was the American League Most Valuable Player that year, he hit 61, and Mickey Mantle hit 54. The Yankees had quite a team in 61, and they did win the World Series, avenging their loss to Pittsburgh the year before. But Steve Miley was born on that date, and he has spent most of his life here in Baton Rouge. And that streak, you know, LSU plays about 7 home games a year. So I haven't added. Have you added up the total number of games?
I have not, but I also have been to every bowl game.
Every bowl game.
Yes.
Well, I'm just thinking that's 44 seasons. And if we say, let's say 7 games, that's 308 consecutive games. That's a lot of hours in Tiger Stadium. And there is a game tomorrow, oh, by the way, a very important one. We'll talk about that and more with Steve Miley. And we're also slated to hear from George Morris after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Coming in just a bit, we're going to hear from George Morris, the remarkable reporter who has been covering the beat in Baton Rouge since 1982. Next year will be 40 years, and he started at the State Times, which published its last issue, last edition, Wednesday, October 1st, 1991, after being in business for nearly 150 years. Now, Steve Miley doesn't have a streak that's 150 years, but every game at Tiger Stadium since Wyoming in 1978, he's been there. He's a videographer for the LSU band, and he gets a 50-yard seat. Do you get paid as well?
No. Volunteer.
Volunteer. Well, that's good. That's admirable, too.
I do love the Tiger band.
I hear they got some deep pockets out there in the athletic department, right?
The band is not the athletic department.
Well, kind of.
Kind of.
I mean, you can't have a you can't have a football team without a band. And I remember back in the day, the band at LSU was named number one in the country.
That's right.
The Golden. That was ABC when they had a one-year contest, and they got the award from Doc Severinsen.
That's right. Bill Swore was the band director.
Yeah. You've been through a few band directors, right?
Yes. Starting with Nick Rouse, then Frank Wicks, and then Roy King, and Linda Morehouse, and Damon Talley, and Cliff Crooms, and Kelvin Jones.
A few of them. Mm-hmm. You've been through almost as many band directors in that time as there have been LSU football coaches.
Sounds like it.
I think since 78, I think I can do it. I bet George can, too. The all LSU football coaches in order since 1978. Charlie McClendon, Bo Rhine, okay, Jerry Stovall, Bill Arnsparger, Mike Archer, Curly Hallman.
You missed an interim, didn't you?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. Jerry DiNardo, Hal Hunter.
Okay.
Nick Saban, Les Miles, Ed Orgeron.
There you go.
I think is that 11? I think it's 11. Whole bunch of guys coaching the LSU football team. But back in the day when Stovall was fired in 83 and George and I were at the board meeting, December 2nd, 1983, and I remember the great John McKithen pontificating as he paced the room, and somebody asked me, "Who is that guy?" I said, "That's Governor McKithen." He goes, "That guy's a governor?" He was putting on a show. Told Bob Broadhead he better wear a bulletproof vest. But
I still have my Keep Jerry sign.
But when Jerry Stovall was fired, I went to see him at Louisiana National Bank, and he was at the teller window handing out cash to people as they were, you know, bringing in checks. He was learning everything. He was vice president of the bank, but he was learning every aspect. Somehow, I think if Coach O is canned, he won't be working at the teller window. He gets $22 million if they fire him this year. Some people would view that as a vacation, but they talk about the pressure of being an LSU football coach, Steve. Some people would invite that pressure. $22 million not to work? What do you think? Is that the way it should be?
I'm not going to comment on that.
I think you should. I think, but you want to keep your volunteer job.
I do.
And you've done that well for 43 years. And LSU plays Auburn tomorrow, 4-point favorites. Auburn hasn't won at LSU Tiger Stadium in a long time. Last time, Senator Tommy Tuberville, now U.S. Senator, was smoking a cigar at midfield, right?
I do remember that.
And LSU has never forgiven Auburn for doing that. And sooner or later, Auburn's got to win. Sooner or later.
The odds.
But LSU is favored tomorrow. Who's going to win, Steve Miley?
Well, LSU, of course.
Of course, of course. This guy obviously wants to keep his volunteer job as videographer. And I hear you do pretty good work. So Congrats. Thanks for being a member of the coffee group. And 60 years for Steve Miley. No relation to Mike Miley. That's the first thing George Morris said. The 1973 quarterback for LSU when George was in the stands in Columbia, South Carolina, when the Tigers beat the Gamecocks 33-29. As we segue, George, I remember you telling him about that. Mike Miley won the game in a duel with Jeff Grants, a great South Carolina quarterback.
Right, and he had one of the most remarkable scrambles I've ever seen, and he was able to find Ben Jones alone on the sidelines, and Ben took it down inside the 5-yard line.
It's like 3rd and 23, and he's running around.
Yes, it was like watching a pinball, you know.
And he found him, and I think that was Tearaway Jersey. Time. They ripped his jersey off.
I can't remember because it was to the far sideline.
I like the tearaway jerseys though. I wish we'd go back to those.
Heck, you know, they can't tackle them now with jerseys that are made of.
But you can grab
stuff.
A guy's hair though. That's well, interesting that's, though. You can grab him by the hair. Now on the school ground, if you did that, you'd end up in a fistic encounter. But it's actually allowed in college football. But then gambling. Who would have thought, George, when you and I were covering the Tigers in the 80s, I once remember Jerry Tarkanian being thrown out of Tiger Stadium. He was in the suites, and he was gambling on every play. Every play. The former coach at UNLV and General Richard escorted him to the elevator and told him it was time to go. Jerry Tarkanian. Now, Caesars is a partner with LSU. What do you make of that?
It's like we're in a different world. It really is.
It is. But what happens when there's a point-shaving scandal? We had one of those at Tulane in 1985. It would seem that when colleges go to bed with the gambling giants, that there's nothing particularly sinister about that, but it does invite more activity on games, which could invite more chicanery.
Correct.
So we'll see. But it was 30 years ago today, and George had already moved over to the Advocate to cover sports at that time, and it was 1991, first year of one Hudson Curly Holman. Curly's first year was the last year for the State Times, and 150 years circulation in 1976 of the afternoon paper was 46,000, which is pretty strong.
Right.
And the Manship family bought the paper in 1909, and the Morning Advocate in 1991 had a circulation of 85,000.
Right.
So we know times have changed, but that was a great newspaper, and I miss it. And the day of an afternoon paper, or maybe even of a morning paper, those days are all but gone.
Well, I don't know if there's an afternoon paper in the country. It's certainly not where there's a morning competition. Television is what killed afternoon newspapers. I mean, for the longest time, probably the afternoon newspaper in the 50s, maybe even into the 60s, was the higher circulation of the two papers in Baton Rouge. And, of course, you're going back. I mean, morning papers were almost afterthoughts because you'd get home, you'd get the paper, you'd read the day's news, and had all the other kinds of entertainment that a newspaper provided. But as people sat down and watched the television, they no longer wanted to have the newspaper at that point. Time, and that's when the morning newspapers took over.
But it was New Orleans, of course, had an afternoon newspaper, the State's Item, and some cities, believe it or not, had 3 or 4 or 5 newspapers. New York still does, but New York is an aberration. There's soon we may not have, if it were not for John George's, I doubt that we would have a daily Baton Rouge Advocate.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think that, if they sold to John George's, I mean, if they wanted to sell, and of course, I was never part of any of those kinds of discussions. I'm sure Gannett would have bought them. Someone would have bought them, and it would have been a daily newspaper.
You see what happens when Gannett buys a newspaper, too. It's pretty condensed, shall we say. It's condensed
yes. I mean, and one of the things that, where Baton Rouge has been extremely fortunate is that we went from one family ownership to another family ownership. And John George's has really bought it almost really as a public service. I mean, he's not doing it really to make money. He's made his money elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And since it's not a publicly traded company, he's not having to make stockholders happy. And so as a result, he's poured a lot of resources into to a newspaper in a market that, you know, I don't know that anyone in our size market has the kind of resources that, that we do. And it's I think the public has benefited from that.
And hats off to him for doing it. And now he has the New Orleans market as well. He's got the Picayune, which is merged with the Advocate. My friend and yours, Steve Myers, laments the fact that we no longer have a New Orleans perception of LSU and a Baton Rouge perception. It's basically monolithic. It's Scott Rabelais is the beat writer. And in the old days, as you know, in those press conferences, there were writers from all over the state covering.
And Scott Rabelais is one of the other State Times alumni who are still hanging in there at the Advocate, as is Sheldon Nichols.
Yeah. Well, you were brought here by the State Times in 1982, and you had worked for another paper that folded, didn't you?
Well, I worked for the Tampa Times, which was the afternoon paper in Tampa, Florida, and its closure is what brought me here.
And if not for that, we would have been deprived of George Morris, who, in addition to everything else, as we have noted on this show, is the number one military historian in the state, one of the top in the country. And Baton Rouge grew on you. I bet when you came here, you didn't expect to be here 40 years.
Well, when I came here, I don't think I had any idea about 40 years. I was not that foresightful at all. But yes, it certainly did grow on me. And it was.
You worked with Sam King and with Dan Hardesty. They were legendary guys, old school. Sam was a guy who he wrote with a bit of a wink and a nod, and had a style that a lot of people embraced.
Yes, I mean, and Sam never took sports. He never treated sports like it was Armageddon. I mean, he knew his readers cared about it, but he also knew it was fun, and he wrote with that sort of attitude. And I think that's what made him very readable.
He was very good, as was George. I loved his column back in the day. You wrote one about Tiger Stadium once, as though Tiger Stadium were a living, breathing person, and in many ways it is. People have their ashes spread at Tiger Stadium, although Herb Vincent once said, "We can't do that. That's hazardous waste." Herb's obviously a sports guy. Yeah. I don't think once a person's been incinerated that there's any danger to the masses to have their ashes in Tiger Stadium. But Herb was concerned.
Well, I'll take your word for it. I'd never heard that.
Yeah, but at any rate. And George, I remember in 1986 when Lynn Bias overdosed on cocaine, he wrote an amazing column about death, a topic many people don't want to touch. We'll talk more with him when we return. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're rounding the corner and heading for home with George Morris, one of the great writers in America who chose Baton Rouge to log most of his career. 40 years next year will be the anniversary. Do you know the precise date?
September 27th, I believe.
Okay, so we're coming up. You're just past 39 years. 9/27/82. George Morris began his career writing for the State Times on the 33rd birthday of Michael Jack Schmidt, greatest third baseman in the history of baseball. But we're talking about the State Times, which died on October 1, 1991. And by the way, today is the 97th birthday of one James Earl Carter, president of the United States from 77 to 81. 97, oldest president ever. It's also the 65th birthday of Mayor President Sharon Weston Broome. So she looks fabulous and is taking good care of herself and is an example to us all, as she is now eligible for Medicare. Mayor Broome, happy 65th. But now here we are. I'm reading this story from the Associated Press when the State Times shut down. It says, born in 1842 as the Democratic Advocate, the newspaper was a highly partisan publication, championing the Democratic Party against the dominant Whig Party. As the country slid toward civil war, the paper, then known as the Daily Advocate, came down on the side of slavery and Southern rights, and during the Civil War, the paper suspended publication shortly before federal troops occupied Baton Rouge, and two owners of the paper fought for the Confederacy. After the war, the Daily Advocate became the Tri-Weekly and Weekly Advocate. Those papers were combined and renamed when the Manship family took over in 1909, and during the 20s and 30s, it was known for its scathing editorials targeting Governor Huey Pierce Long, who survived an impeachment drive supported by the paper in 1929. So a rich history, and I'm glad we have a few people alive and well and still at it who were there in 1991. How were you informed that this was going to happen? It was about a six-month process, wasn't it, George?
Well, the funny thing, and let me kind of give you a little bit of the sort of the backstory, is that when the manships decided to they were going to close the paper, they called a meeting with the department heads and let them know. And of course, obviously, at this point, no personnel decisions had been made. None of the big decisions had been made. And I confirmed this with David Manship, who was the publisher at the time. He told him, "Listen, just keep this to yourselves. We need to be able to do this in an orderly way." And he confirmed that by the time he left the conference room and got back to his office, he's getting calls from outside the building wondering about the closing of the State Times. So it was sort of the worst kept secret.
Journalists are awful at keeping secrets.
Right.
Just awful.
Right.
Biggest gossips in the world.
So that was at some point during the week. And it's kind of interesting. Greg Garland, who was a wonderful, wonderful reporter. I remember that week he approaching me in the elevator school. I said, "George, have you heard anything about them closing the State Times?" I said, "Oh, Greg, I hadn't heard anything." And it was that Friday that they broke the news, partly because it had just gotten out of hand. It was the talk all over town. So they just simply announced, "We're going to do this." And it was weeks before they ultimately told us whether we had a job or not. Mm-hmm. It was a rather uncomfortable passage of time.
But you segued over to the Advocate and covered sports there many years. And
right.
Now George covers everything and covers everything well. He is not a person who, as Howard Cosell said, has dugout vision. You know, one-dimensional guy. I just want to cover the games and the people. I don't want any controversy. I don't want any politics. I don't want to hear about science or space or anything else. In fact, speaking of space, our former colleague,
Howard
Arsenault, his daughter, who would have thought, she went to space.
She went to space on the SpaceX. That was really a wonderful thing. When she had cancer, and was being treated at St. Jude, I had done a story about how that entire West Feliciana parish community had just rallied around her in ways that were just remarkable and unusual. And then, of course, Howard himself died of cancer in 2018, and she took some memorabilia from him, some of the St. Jude tie that he wore and some other things. She took that on that mission in his honor.
Lester Duay, my colleague at the Reveille 40 years ago, great friend and talented political consultant, writes, "I've always enjoyed George's writings. Sam King made sure his photograph was on that sports page once LSU started winning those baseball national championships. So his photo is on all the posters and bars and restaurants of commemorating the national title." And he says, "My best to George." George, you're, I know how old you are. You're a little bit older, not much, but a little bit older than the mayor president. And you could stop, but I sure hope you don't. What are you going to keep doing this a while?
You're asking me a question of that I'm not sure. I'm not going to keep doing this forever. We have plans to be near one of our daughters in Tennessee and two of our grandchildren in the greater Nashville area. And exactly when that takes place. It has been, it's been wonderful, but family trumps all.
And you grew up in South Carolina.
Grew up in South Carolina, North Augusta, right by Augusta, Georgia.
And you're a Southern guy. You're not moving to Los Angeles or Portland or Boston. George is going to move to Nashville, which is a good city, great city.
Right. Well, it is. It's funny. When I came here, I had a job offer in St. Louis, and I turned it down because it was the specifics of the job were just not what I wanted. Turns out that newspaper closed like 15 months later, and so I was able to dodge another bullet.
Which newspaper was it?
It was the old St. Louis Globe Democrat.
The Globe Democrat and the Post Dispatch.
I
remember Bob Bragg was, I think, the Globe Democrat guy, but that was another afternoon paper, wasn't it?
I honestly don't recall. But the Globe Democrat went under.
Well, what has it done with people tethered to their phones and their computers reading news rather than consuming it the old-fashioned way. Some of us still carry newspapers around. Are people as informed as they were before? Or are we getting news on the run like we do everything else?
I think people are certainly informed. I think that, you know, the digital environment gives them the opportunity to hear a lot more voices. Now, I'm not sure that as a practice people are taking advantage of that and listening to a lot more voices. I think that there, people are often on their Twitter and their Facebook feeds and whatever, they're sort of isolating themselves with voices that they tend to agree with as opposed to hearing diverse voices. But the opportunity to be well-informed has probably never been better.
877-217-5757. Alondra Villarreal is producing. Do we have time to take a call or two? She is nodding yes. Henry at the Country Club. Henry, good morning. You're on with George. Hi, Henry. Henry, can you hear me?
Hey, Mr. Jim. Hey, Mr. George. How y'all doing?
Great.
I was afraid that new super-duper phone system was about to drop me, but you came through. Look here, I had a question, and of course, we all know that Henry doesn't say bad words on the radio, so Henry doesn't have to get suspended like some of these people do. But I was wondering if Mr. George knew if they had a poster or picture or something. One year when the Saints weren't doing too well, Sam King had his picture on the front page of the sports section on a Sunday morning, as usual, wearing a bag over his head with that cigar stuck out of it. And I was wondering if y'all still had a copy of that picture.
I remember that distinctly. I don't know that we do. I think I might be able to find sort of a digital copy of the page, but I don't know that it actually would have and I think it may have been artwork rather than an actual photograph. But I do remember him doing that when the Saints fans were putting bags over their heads.
All right. Stafford Wood writes, I had the privilege of sitting next. Thank you, Henry, by the way. I had the privilege of sitting next to George for 6 years at The Advocate. He's insightful and one of the funniest people I've ever had the pleasure of working with. She says she's listening to on the WRKF app in Austin, Texas, and says, ask George about obituary nicknames.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, there was a time when Stafford and I sat very close to each other, and one of the things that fascinated me when I would read our obituary pages is, of course, the obituaries would often have prominently with the name their nickname. And some of the nicknames were just things that you would kind of expect. And some of them were so unusual and just descriptive that I was saving them. I quit that practice literally decades ago, but I used to regale my coworkers with some of the more colorful nicknames.
And now with the printed version of many newspapers coming out days later, some of these obits run after the person's dead and in the ground. That's unfortunate.
Well, yes, I mean, and that's one of the great things that we still do have a daily newspaper, so that doesn't happen here. But yes, if you're in an environment where you've gone to 3 day a week publication or 2 day a week publication or 1 day a week, yes, but I mean, by the time you read the obituary, it's too late to pay your respects.
And to show you what John Georges is doing and how he should be paid tribute for keeping the flame going, I spent 10 years of my youth in Little Rock in that newspaper there, has the highest circulation of any newspaper in the South outside the Texas papers in Dallas and Houston, and yet it's now a 1 day a week print. 1 day, Sunday. That's it. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette. But you can get The Advocate every day, and on many of those days, you have George writing about even religion. He's now the religion expert in addition to being the military authority. So, George, I don't know of anybody more versatile than you, and I hope you won't be going to Nashville as soon as you might. And thanks for First Financial Tax and Accounting Services providing for signature support. Until Monday, for Alondra Villarreal, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe. Stay tuned.